Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Our first guest today is Philippe Petit. You know him as the man on wire who walked between the two Trade Center towers. He's back with a new book called Creativity, and he'll be joining us first.
Good morning, Lynn. Our second guest is Austin Kleon, author of Show Your Work. It's also about the creative process, but about how you get that creativity out there into the real world.
Yes. And Tim, you were on assignment somewhere in the world when John Wells and I interviewed him. It's a taped interview. We thought we'd fit in between our other interviews today. Really interesting. Then our third guest will be Jovita Bidlavska. She's the author of the book Drunk Mom, a memoir. It's one mom's brutally honest fight to beat addiction. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch in Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from deposit accounts to business lending. We have one branch in Park City and two branches in Heber and Midway, Heber Valley Bank. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time Instacare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza Instacare, 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, you remember Philippe Petit, the man on wire who walked between the two World Trade Center towers back in the early 70s. It was an act of extreme precision and planning, of inspired desire, and of what Petit would call creativity in his most famous act of artistic rebellion. But he says it was just one moment, he would argue, in a lifetime of transgression, subversion, and brave artistic acts. Any truly creative act, he says, requires transgression. And we'll hear more about what he defines transgression as being. He's joining us to, to talk about how creativity is perceived by the masses and how we define it for ourselves, and also how we can redefine it. He's written a book called Creativity. Philippe Petit, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you, and I want to get this one question out of the way before we start, because I couldn't help but, through everything, when I saw Man on Wire and when I was looking through your book, I couldn't help but wonder how you felt when the Twin Towers went down.
Well, that's a personal question, because of the, amazing, horrendous human tragedy that day. I don't think it's right for me to talk about, how I felt when the two towers disappeared. It was a human tragedy and not an architectural tragedy. But you can imagine how I felt, because those towers were very much in my heart from the beginning.
Right. Okay. What you call a creative endeavor, and I think it's so interesting that instead of calling it a daredevil act or a stunt, it's a creative endeavor. So talk about the creative part of execution, inspiration, and all of that that goes with it.
Well, you see, I was lucky, because I was not born in the circus, so I didn't learn all the tradition and the way of walking the wire that circus people do. So I walk the wire in a very different way. And actually, for me, it's not an act of pushing my body from one side to the other of a precipice or a crossing. To me, it's an act of creation. To me, it's a poem written in the sky with my body and with the help of a very narrow stage. And that's what I become an expert as writing in the sky. And so first I have to create a place when I'm being invited to perform in a city for an anniversary or whatever. Then my first act of creation is to decide from where to where. And then as a man of theater, as a theatrical director, in a way, I have to decide what kind of performance. If it's a historic commemoration, of course, maybe I'm going to wear a historic costume or have a music of the time to make the audience recall the event that I am illustrating. And then there will be light and music and costume and moments of theater. So to me, very often, my wire walks are very, very different from the word you use at the beginning, stunt and daredevilry, that you find by tradition, you know, in mm-hmm. Barnum and in the circus. Mine are more the theater, the opera, the filmmaking, the poetry, and that's why my audience call it an art, and that's why they gave me that beautiful title, High Wire Artist.
So, Philippe, this aspect of the artist and getting back to the beginning of your artistic endeavors, and how did that come to you? Do you think that there was an innate aspect to you, or is the human condition that we're all artists at one point or another when we're born, and then we transform into other things? Or is there a difference? Is there an inequality in artistic nature?
I think, but it's really my way of thinking. I think there is no such thing as being predisposed for an action or for a spirit. I think we all carry everything in us, but because of the crazy modern life that we live, sometimes we forget the marvel that are in seed form inside us. So I think anybody who decide to either transform or change their life or create the life that they want, and you can call it, pursuing the impossible or making your dream happen, I think anybody can has the power and the ability to do just that, except this invitation to have a wonderful life is usually not taught in school, and it should.
And so let's pursue that thought, that concept, or that thread of pursuing the impossible. You decided I think it was a choice for you at some point at a very early age that you were going to pursue the impossible, and the impossible was, in fact, possible. And then your training, as you just stated, was not traditional. You weren't brought up in the circus, and it gave you a much different way of framing and forming your artistry. When did that happen?
You know, it happened very early. I remember around 5-6 years old, as a little kid, I had that taste for, maybe not for perfection at the time, but for working hard and creating a good result. I was proud of something well done, which is kind of rare in a kid's mind. And of course, that led me to learn magic by myself at age 6, juggling at age 14, and the high wire age 17. All those things without teachers, which is a very unusual path. And that's why I decided, after a lifetime of creativity, to share my thoughts and my life in the form of a book.
Well, Philippe, what can you share with us about this concept of perfection? Because, you know, we hear oftentimes that there is no such thing as perfection. And if you get caught pursuing perfection, that's a trap. But you haven't really lived into that. You really believe that there is some form of perfection that you have grasped and held.
Well, there is an entire chapter dedicated to perfection in my book, because I rebel against the idea that perfection is an unattainable goal. I think if you look at perfection as a formidable goal, then you will just run away and in fear, in cowardice. But I think if you approach slowly, like one step at a time, you can find that you can progress in whatever activity is your life. And every progress is a small victory, and the collection of victory makes you every day, every minute, closer to this unattainable perfection. So I think too often we hide our limits with things like fear, vertigo, or you know, the impossible, perfection, all those made up notions. But actually, I think in life, the boundary between those notions is much more blurred.
Mm. Philippe, perfection, I would assume, consists of elements like execution and completion. And yet creativity, so many times we're told and we tell, you know, young children, it's about the process, not the product. Yet for you, it's very much about the product because it's about completion. And I'm wondering if what you're trying to do in your book is to help people not only have the creative process, experience that, but also experience the perfection that lies in completion.
Well, I'm glad you used the word experience because actually this book is not a treatise on creativity. It's the book of a traveler in the land of creativity. Everything I share with the reader are not thoughts, but they are experience, living experience, life experience. So that is very important. And, you know, there is nothing taught to the reader in this book. There are invitations to venture in different directions, sometimes directions that were unbeknownst to you. So that's what I think is the very unique nature of my book, is I spent a lifetime learning by myself, and now I share that process or that mysterious alchemy with the reader, and it's for everyone to pick up from my stories, whatever can help them achieve a wondrous life.
Yes, and the way you present your book and the concepts in it, and really the metaphors of life that you sometimes address as something very physical, which would be balance, or are you left-footed, or things like this. How did you decide on this sort of format where you're sharing stories and metaphors all at the same time?
Well, I share a little bit that with the reader in a sense that I invite the reader to follow how I go from one idea to an achievement. And the book itself was exactly that. I started with the chaotic mass and mess of ideas, and then I organized this chaos until it had a certain order, and that gave me the skeleton, the plan, so to speak, of my book. And that format, that way of welcoming chaos and then sorting it into a plan of sorts to be able to start working on a goal is what I do each time I address a creative process, you know, be it a highway walk, legal or not, or street juggling, or my new one-man show on stage. Each time is more or less the same process, and it works for me, and that's why I'm sharing it with the reader.
Philippe, I'm going to ask you something fairly personal, but since you've written a book already, I think it won't be all that personal. But it seems to me, you just said it, you've made an invitation to people in the way that you've organized this chaotic process of creativity to pursue a wondrous life. And, you know, there are other people who do the same thing, and they do it through a different context. The Dalai Lama through meditation and finding inner peace and self-reflection and letting go of desire, those sorts of things. You have done it through the process of creativity. How has your life played out? Have you lived a full expression of a wondrous life?
Absolutely, and actually every day I am surprised by the invitation that the day offers to shape that day in the best way possible. So I also like to surprise myself, you know, to not fall into a system that works, to be always on the edge, and pun intended, of course, I am balancing on a high wire throughout my life, but in life I am balancing as well. And I refuse, that's why the word rebellion is coming back all the time. I refuse to accept the only one way of living, on one way of thinking. And therefore, yes, I can say I have no regret about my life, and my life continues to be an adventure, and I think life should be an adventure, a pleasant one and full of surprises. And I think you could be the architect of your own life.
Philippe, what does fear look like for you?
Well, fear is just a word in my dictionary, and probably I have crossed out that word, you know, like the word impossible or the word vacation or retirement. Fear is probably, if I had to explain what fear is to a toddler, you know, I would probably say that fear is not knowing. Because, you know, for example, I am fearful of snake and spiders. And why? Well, because they are so different than us. They have too many legs or they have no legs at all. But if I were intellectually courageous enough, or if I decide it's a time for me to erase that fear, I would simply learn about those animals. And I will get, by learning, I would get to love them. And loving them, they'll become my friends. And I will have no problem having a giant spider crawl on my arm.
Philippe, where do you see your journey of creativity taking you next?
Well, because I advocate intuition and improvisation, I do not know where my travel of creativity will take me next. But what I can say is I have in my sleeves a lot of projects. I continue all my art. I continue to write, to draw, to build barn, to lecture, to make films, to write books, to walk on the wire, to street juggle. So I know that I will never stop, or I will stop when my body will really give up, but that's not for a long time. So that is the beauty of a life in creativity, is that you don't know what's next.
Let's pursue that a little bit. Not knowing what's next and having all these things up your sleeve, when is it that something... when is it when you connect with something and you say, this is it, this is the next thing that I'm going to do? As that six-year-old who saw the card trick and learned how to do the card trick, as the older child who learned how to walk the wire and built the construct to teach himself how to walk the wire, what is that connection look like?
You see, the reason I think this book is very original and intriguing and will inspire people and entertain people is because it's exactly that, is that this is not a thought discourse. This is a result of a lifetime of trial and error and journey and adventure and exploring. And when you ask me, how do you know what your next creative effort will be, I do not know, and I do not plan those things. Sometimes, you know, a little detail in life makes me think of, oh, I should write a book about that. Oh, I should make drawing and exhibit my drawings, or I should build a barn. So those things kind of fall on me. And when I look at my entire life, it's surprising because somebody who pays so much attention to detail and who advocates planning before doing something difficult is also the same person who welcomes the unknown. You see, and so sometimes I use that expression, it fell from the sky, you know, it fell on me. I decided to write a new book, so very often in my life, I see things that were not planned. Now, of course, maybe they were unconsciously planned, that's possible. But anyway, I like surprises, and I welcome surprises.
Philippe, you said at some point that when you were young, you just never thought of consequences. As you'd walk on the high wire, you didn't think of what could possibly happen. But do you think of consequences now? And I imagine you're someone who doesn't want to bring the young versus old even into your repertoire of conversation. But I'm wondering how you view things now, if it has changed.
No, nothing has changed, and I am still very young at heart. I use very often the childlike expression, which is better than childish, and I really continue to refuse to grow up. So age doesn't exist for me, and actually there are no limitations, I think. It's almost the opposite. I feel I am much more in control of my craft and of my life today at 65 than I was when I was a bold 18 years old trying to prove to the world, you know?
Yes. I can't remember. I believe you came to the Sundance Film Festival when Man on Wire...
Yes.
Show. So that's where we are in Park City. And
Oh, great. Well, that was the beginning of a 45-degree ascent of that wonderful film until we got the Oscar, and I hope you saw me balance the Oscar on my chin that day.
Yes.
I remember that, yeah.
We're speaking with Philippe Petit. He's the author of Creativity, The Perfect Crime.
Well, Philippe, I just say, since you've been to Park City once during the Sundance Film Festival, you know that it's a place that you align with because, as you said, childlike. You are childlike. We're a community that is full of people that are childlike. So I would just invite you the next time you're in Park City to come and see us at KPCW, and we'll sit down and have another chat.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Best of luck to you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Well, Austin Kleon has written a book for people who hate the very idea of self-promotion. It's called Show Your Work. It's the follow-up to Kleon's New York Times best-selling guide to creativity, Steal Like an Artist. If Steal Like an Artist was a book about stealing influence from others, Show Your Work is about influencing others by letting them steal from you. Now, while Tim was away on assignment, as we like to say, John Wells and I interviewed Austin Kleon. It's a taped interview. And here we go. Austin Kleon, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Austin, we spoke to you, I don't know, was it 2 years ago with your book, Steal Like an Artist, which was a great amount of fun. And you're back with one that, you know, sort of reminds me of that one in that you pick it up and it catches your attention. So how did you do that?
Well, you know, it's very important to me that my books are actually readable. Like, there's something, you know, this sounds strange for an author to say, but, you know, there's so many books that you pick up and you don't really feel like reading, you know? And so I want my books to be fun, and I want people to spend as little time reading them as possible because I want them to get to work after they read it, you know? And so try to make it quick, try to make it, you know, illustrated and fun to read.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny that we are so distracted in this age of technology that oftentimes maybe we don't even pick up a book with paper pages in it at all. But this, the way you have designed your book, it makes it so accessible that it's almost like technology in that it's giving us these little quips. It's catering to our distracted minds, you might say.
Well, you know, my friend Robin Sloan, the author, he likes to talk about, you know, books actually are a technology. You know, they are a device in a sense, you know, and they do certain things and they do certain things well. And so it's kind of funny in this day and age with all the digital technology, taking advantage of the full range of things that a book can do, you know, the way it changes when you turn a page, the page spreads, the way you can do illustrations. I think it's a really interesting time to do books, and I just want to take full advantage of the form.
Yeah. Austin, Lynn and I have had the opportunity to speak to a number of paleontologists and astrophysicists, nanotechnologists, biologists, even a cold fusion physicist. And it appears to us sort of a central theme of these conversations is where they used to work in isolated islands, they now collaborate with other people in other disciplines. And it's made a tremendous difference to their work as they collaborate with others. And that's sort of a central theme of your book.
Yeah, that's something that has been, you know, on my journey of kind of, you know, developing my own writing and my own art. I've realized just how collaborative creativity and innovation and really all work is. And my favorite idea around the subject comes from Brian Eno, the musician, the producer. You know, he says that you know, great leaps in innovation or creativity throughout time, they aren't often the result of just a genius, you know, that lone genius working alone. They're often the result of what he calls a senius, which is the senius is a whole group of people working together, you know, kind of sharing ideas, swapping ideas, influencing each other. And so when I read about that idea about senius, I thought, man, we're living in such a connected world, and so much of getting your work out there is about becoming part of a senius. I wonder if we all need kind of a new way of operating, and that you don't think about, because self-promotion is very much an idea of being a lone genius, you know, having something from yourself that you people need to know about, whereas, you know, sharing, becoming part of a senius, that's very much about how you insert yourself into the world, right? And so that's what I wanted to write about in this book.
Exactly. And speaking of music, I wanted to add one thing. I really got a kick out of this in your book. When Radiohead frontman Tom York, who has been called a genius, was asked what he thought his greatest strength was, he answered that I didn't know what I was doing. And he was just sort of working, kind of winging it, and very successfully.
Yeah, I mean, Tom York is one of those guys who he's making it up as he goes along. He's got that amateur spirit, you know, that kind of beginner's kind of lifelong learner's attitude. And one of the things that Tom York stole from one of his favorite songwriters, Tom Waits, who's also one of my favorites, is
of course,
whenever Tom Waits gets blocked when it comes to songwriting, he picks up an instrument he doesn't know how to play. And so in the act of picking up this instrument that he's not sure how to play, he starts tinkering with it. And, you know, often, you know, there's a great quote from the Zen monk Shunryu Suzuki. He says, you know, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. Mm. And so there's something about being a beginner and picking up something that you're not really sure how it works. You know, the possibilities are limitless, and you could do anything with it. And so that's something I, you know, try to write about with people is, you know, pick up a piece of technology or a new tool that you don't know how it works. And sometimes that's the way to get a lot of new ideas.
The story that you write about, I love so much, about the late film critic Roger Ebert, brings this to light. When he lost his voice, he developed these other modes of communication that in turn allowed him to be more creative.
Yeah, I mean, Roger Ebert literally, and I'm using that word correctly, he literally lost his voice when he went through his cancer surgeries. And so what he discovered is in the act of blogging and jumping on Facebook and Twitter and talking to his audience, he said, on the web, my true voice finds expression. And I found that to just be very poignant. Here's a guy who literally lost his voice, and he turned to social media and the internet, and he found a whole new voice. And the whole reason we have his great memoir, Life Itself, is because he took to blogging, and he took to Facebook and Twitter, and he put himself out there. And I just find that to be really inspirational for me personally.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Austin Kleon. He's the author of Show Your Work, 10 Ways to Share Your Creativity and Get Discovered.
I want to go back to something you said about being an amateur. Is this a mindset, do you think, that we should adopt, that regardless of how successful you've been in a particular area or how accomplished you have become, that if you adopt the attitude of continuing to be an amateur with...
Well, I think of, I think of some of the great scientists, you know, Richard Feynman or Albert Einstein. They were all able to retain this sort of curiosity about the world, and they were able to, you know, they didn't go into their TED Talk phase where all they did was do the conference circuit and just, you know, lecture about their own ideas on and on. These people were able to continue to do their work and to continue to be curious. And I think that the people who really get ahead in this day and age, because the world is changing so quickly, it turns us all into students eventually, that the people who can retain that amateur spirit and the people who can remain lifelong students, those are the ones that get ahead simply because they can adapt to whatever world they find themselves in, and they retain that sense of curiosity and lifelong learning.
And Austin, does humility play a role in this, in the amateur mindset?
Yeah, I think humility is mainly, I think humility in some ways is just actively being empathetic and thinking about the people on the other end of what you're trying to share. I mean, if you see yourself as just part of something bigger, you know, that has a humility is obviously the product of that. And so I think the way to go about, you know, a humility that isn't false is to really think about the people on the other end of what you're trying to share, and to really put the things that you're sharing through a kind of generosity test, which is, are the things you're sharing going to be interesting or helpful to the other people that you're trying to reach? And to really be honest with yourself and really try to, you know, to feel that out, and to always think about the generosity aspect of sharing.
Mm-hmm. I was having a conversation with someone who is an artist, and I explained that the concept of stealing wasn't really stealing. It was more, you know, gaining inspiration from this collective canon of art out there. And he said, yeah, I steal a lot as an artist. I'm not going to reproduce someone's work and then charge for it, but to kind of, you know, bolster your creativity and your inspiration, you have to borrow from others. So tie that in together for us.
Well, I think that, you know, it's funny. I think one of the first ways to figure out how to share your own work is to start sharing the work of others. And so to think about your inspirations and your influences, think about the people in your profession that are doing work that you think is really top-notch, and start sharing their work first before you're ready to share your own. You know, start shining a spotlight on the work of others. And when you start sharing the work of others, then you can just pretend that your own work is someone else's work, you know, and you can, that's kind of like, I think one of the best ways to self-promote yourself is just pretend that you're not yourself. Pretend that you're someone else promoting your work or sharing your work. And I think that when you start sharing the work of others, then it's pretty easy to kind of switch into that mode of sharing your own. But more than anything, I think that when, you know, all of us are influenced, all of us take inspiration from others, it's just a good whether you believe in karma or whether you believe what goes around comes around, you know, sharing credit and honoring our influences and our inspirations, I think it only does good for the community as a whole and for us as individuals.
You had a chapter titled "My Work Does Not Speak for Itself," and that was interesting. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, I run into these people a lot. You know, they kind of, you ask them about their work and they kind of, you know, cross their arms and say, my work speaks for itself, you know. And in my experience, work doesn't speak for itself. That actually the things you say about your work, the stories you tell about your work, actually have a huge impact on how people feel about your work, what they think about it, and ultimately, you know, whether they value it or not. And so when it comes to sharing your own work, I think the more you can become a good storyteller and tell the story of how your work was made and what it was made for, I think that makes your work even more powerful.
Hmm. Yeah, it does add value.
So, Austin, I have to take you back to the Don't Be a Hoarder chapter.
Sure.
As soon as I saw hoarder, I thought, well, what can he possibly mean? And then suddenly I get it. It's stagnation. It's about stagnation. And so all of this that you've been talking about, if we don't do, it contributes to our own stagnation. And talk about why that's bad.
Yeah, I mean, anything you keep to yourself, it kind of dies with you, you know, in a sense. There's something about when you share your influences. You know, one of the things I think is really interesting about sharing your influences and you know, letting someone, say you're a musician and you let another musician borrow one of your favorite albums that no one knows, you know, not a lot of people know about, then you might be at their show the next day and they've taken a riff from that music or they've done something interesting with it and put it in a song, and they do something with your influence that you might have not thought of yourself. You know, and so one of the things about sharing your influences and kind of encouraging other people to steal from them and do their own thing with it is that you just learn more. And I think that's what the book is really about, is that when you share things that you're passionate about and you put them out in the world, you learn so much because you watch the way people respond to it. And so putting your work out into the world, it's almost like a free education that goes on for a lifetime.
There's so many examples of that, and one that comes to mind that I've always enjoyed was when Bob Dylan came out with All Along the Watchtower as a song in one of his albums. And 1 week later, he was sitting in the audience of a Jimi Hendrix concert, and Jimi had covered the song and had completely changed it, and it blew Dylan away. And Dylan said of all the covers and of all the interpretation of his work, he'll never forget what Hendrix did in a matter of listening to the song and immediately reinterpreting it. And, you know, I think it's a great example of that.
Oh, I love that story. That's one of my favorite stories. And that's actually happened in my life personally. I mean, I started my career doing these things called newspaper blackout poems, where I take an article from a newspaper and I black out most of the words, just leaving a few words behind. It sort of looks like if the CIA did haiku.
Oh, sure.
So one of the things I did when I first started working on these is I encouraged other people to try the form, and I actually started a site called newspaperblackout.com where people could try out the form and send me their own works. And the thing I was not expecting is I found out so much. I learned so much from what people sent me about their work. I learned, new ways that people took the technique, and I learned, there was so much for me to steal from. It's almost benefited me more than it did the people who I set the website up for. So that's the interesting thing, is when you put your work out in the world and then people take it and they do something new with it, it shows you something that you never would have thought of yourself.
Right. You know, Austin, it's so funny because when I saw that in your book, that medium or whatever you would call it, your artwork where you use the blackout, I saw a massive show at Mass MoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts.
Oh, Tom Phillips.
Yeah. Oh, and I was fascinated, but it is literally hundreds of those. So that's so great that you know of that one.
Yeah, I write about Tom Phillips in my first book, Newspaper Blackout. And that's the other thing. You want to talk about learning. When I first started making my poems, I wasn't aware of Tom's work. And one of the things that happened is when I first started sharing my work, I would get all these emails that were like, Tom Phillips called and he wants his idea back, and or William Burroughs is rolling in his grave, something like that. And so what was interesting was when people told me all the people I was ripping off through this form that I thought was completely original, instead of quitting, what I did was I went back and I found this whole 250-year history of taking poetry from the newspaper. And so, again, you put work out into the world and, gosh, even if it's not original, you learn something from it in a way. And what I did was I took all those people that had come before me, and I said, okay, well, they made this work. What can I make that's different? And how can I make my poems, how can I push it into something of my own?
That's good. Maybe there should be an end to that saying, there are no original ideas. There just are greater ideas that are born out of those original ideas.
Yeah, maybe, it's all about, but I think this is just what work and innovation and creativity is. We just take the things that came before us and we just push them into a new place.
Very good. Well, Austin Kleon, thanks so much for joining us today. The book is Show Your Work, 10 Ways to Share Your Creativity and Get Discovered. And it's been a pleasure talking with you again.
Thanks so much for having me. Look forward to next time.
And again, Austin Kleon will be back in just a moment with Jovita Bidlavska. She's the author of the book Drunk Mom, a memoir. Very interesting. So stay with us.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club and sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is Park City's in-town private country club, just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, the title of the book is clear, bold, and simple, yet it's meant to carry with it the contradiction that it is. The book is called Drunk Mom, a Memoir. To be a mother requires the utmost of care, responsibility, selflessness, attentiveness, none of which can be achieved when succumbing to alcoholism. Our next guest takes us through her own daunting and exposing and really brutally honest memoir of how she, a recovered alcoholic, so easily re-submerged herself into the dark place that is alcoholism when her baby was just months old, and how she looks back on it now, now recovered or recovering, as I believe the correct lexicon goes. Jovita Sidlowska, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And first of all, let's just start here. I'm wondering, since your book came out first in Canada, then in the U.S., you know, you've exposed yourself in the biggest of ways. What has been the reaction? I've read some different reactions about this, because people would be very incensed about a mom who's not taking care of her infant baby.
Certainly. It's been a mixed reaction. I do think that, you know, whether positive or negative reaction to my particular story or any story about addiction is good, because it, you know, it opens the door to discussion about what addiction is. It lets us talk about the stigma of addiction, you know. And in my case, it was in the context of raising a child. But I tried to show that, you know, motherhood and love and my responsibility was no match for addiction.
And addiction in and of itself, I mean, I would assume that those who suffer from addiction, they understand, the rest don't. But with the story of the most important job in the world, really, being a mom and bringing this story, makes it somehow more honest and more probing.
I mean, certainly, you know, and you introduced the story with saying, you know, that it is a selfless and a very responsible task that we have as especially as mothers, but I'm sure fathers as well. But it is a situation, especially for the first time, where we're sort of thrown into it without, you know, any instruction manual. I mean, we can get some lessons from our own mothers or grandmothers, but it's a very isolating to many. I'm not saying to everyone, but it's a very isolating new experience that not a lot of us know how to deal with it. You know, my particular story of involved addiction, but, you know, there are things like postpartum depression or, you know, people are overeating or shopping excessively, like things that, you know, women sometimes do in order to deal with this isolation and this, you know, confusion over being a new parent.
Jovita, I'm curious as to what your condition with your addiction and alcoholism was prior to the birth of your son, Hugo. How long had you been recovered, and what was your struggle earlier in life?
Sure. Well, prior to his birth, I was sober for 3.5 years. And, you know, I got sober in my late 20s as a result of my own realization that, you know, my drinking was a little different than the one of my peers, and that, you know, it interfered with a lot of things in my life, affected my daily life. So, but, you know, in sobriety, I got a lot of my, you know, my life back. I got a great job, and I, you know, my relationship was repaired. I had a place to live. So, you know, there was no evidence that sobriety was not working for me. Everything worked in its favor. So,
well, and I'm kind of curious as to the extent and degree of, you know, this issue of addiction, because that's really, I mean, you're telling two stories here, and one is you know, parenthood and the stresses and challenges with being a parent, but the other one is, as you say, you're shining a light on this this issue of addiction by putting it within the context of being a parent and having a baby, which is a really powerful context.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I'm kind of curious as to how big an issue it was for you in your 20s, and what was it that made you say, oh, wow, I'm an alcoholic and I need to get sober?
Well, like I said, it was more, you know, it was just an idea that it was interfering with my everyday life. You know, I lost a job, not due to my drinking, but shortly before, you know, I became sober. My relationship wasn't going well. My roommates were talking about possibly kicking me out. So there were a lot of sort of, you know, events that happened, and alcohol in my lifestyle seemed to be a common denominator. But, you know, sorry, I lost track. So.
Well, that's okay, because yeah. That segues into kind of where I want to go with this, which mm-hmm. is, so then you have this powerful, instinctive moment, you know, you're a mother, and that's mm-hmm. huge. So there's the context, mm-hmm. and one drink throws you back in. And as you said, you know, something about you wasn't powerful enough or strong enough to ward off this overwhelming connection with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
how did that happen? And what is it about? I guess my question is, what is it about you? And is it just about you, or is there some common element that you feel with other addicts?
Well, I certainly, you know, I can tell you that, you know, in the U.S., there's approximately 4 million women who, you know, meet criteria for drug abuse. And women, you know, there are studies that show it that we experience greater stigma when it comes to substance use. So a lot of the times it's hard to tell, you know, how common something is. Like, you know, I'm only talking about my own experience. And, you know, you're asking me, what was it in me? I mean, I'm honestly not sure, because, you know, there's studies showing that it's sometimes genetic component, that it's early childhood trauma, things like that. But, I mean, I have a chapter near the end where I'm listing all the possible reasons. And that's sort of done tongue-in-cheek to show that it could be all of the reasons. Mm. It could be one reason. It could be nothing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jovita, your son was 6 months old. You had been sober. You had your son. He's 6 months old. You're celebrating with friends. And, you know, champagne is poured. And it all seems very benign and even deserved, as you go on to explain that it's hard to be the parent of this little blob of flesh that is waking up constantly. And it's stressful. And your friends sort of present it as, oh, just, you know, relax and have a glass of champagne, entirely benign, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, how did it switch so easily, do you think?
You know, it's everyone's different when it comes to their addiction or whatever their demons are. For me, the only way for me to stay sober and healthy is to be completely abstinent from alcohol. So for me, that one glass of champagne wasn't necessarily, you know, that's what made me an alcoholic, just that one glass. But what that had done was it gave me permission to possibly have more in the future. And, you know, I like to say there's almost like a switch in my brain that says, you know, yeah, that one glass may as well, you know, if you threw all your sobriety out the window, so, you know, why not have another one? And mm-hmm. there is certainly this, you know, this thing where we have a strange trend of, you know, mommy juice and mommy's drinking after a hard day of, you know, working with being with the baby, and there's lots of mommy blogs talking about, you know, mommy and martini, things like that. So there is a certain permission, I think, even in media and popular culture, for moms to have a drink. And, you know, and some of us are just not doing that well if we do. So
mm-hmm. I found that to be very interesting, the whole idea of, you know, bringing your kids together for play dates and having a couple bottles of wine. And it is very interesting how it seems like, you know, you're part of a club and this is the stage of life and we need to cut ourselves a break and we deserve this and all of that, and how an addict could pretend to herself that she's just part of that benign club. But I would imagine that even, you know, other people in this club, alcohol does not become so benign, after all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah.
That was very interesting. So then, what did you do? What was the impetus to stop? You looked at this little adoring being that looked mm-hmm. up at his mother. It must have had to do with the love created there.
Mm-hmm. Partly. I mean, because I'm honest in my book, I do want to stay honest. So I don't want to say that, you know, it was my son that got me sober, because to say that would be to say that, you know, that there was something wrong with me that made me drink in the first place, because my love for him was constant and consistent. So mm-hmm. But I would say that it was more like a, you know, mental rock bottom almost that I reached, where I finally realized that me staying in his life was more harmful to him than me leaving his life. And you can interpret mm-hmm. that in however you'd like. But to come to that realization, to actually, you know, remove yourself from the life of your child that you love so much, I think that's a pretty morally bankrupt situation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, it was more of a mental break that, you know, that was that started off, you know, my sobriety. And then I had this moment of clarity where I realized that, you know, it's either me continuing with my lies and with my manipulations and trying to, you know, keep the train going a little longer, or, you know, becoming truthful, admitting to what was going on, and possibly suffering consequences. Because, you know, once I say, oh, I'm an alcoholic and I've been dealing with this, there's all kinds of things like, you know, losing custody of my child, losing my home, losing my relationship. But I was willing to take that risk and stay sober.
So, Jovita, there comes a point with an addict, hopefully, and in your case, it did, where you say you hit rock bottom mm-hmm. and you were able to make, I mean, you have to make a choice. There's still that ability to make a choice. And when you encountered your alcoholism, there really was no choice. You were overwhelmed. Even the most powerful, instinctive motivation of motherhood was overwhelmed by your connection to addiction. But at some point, you were able to make that choice. Can you speak to the ability to make that choice in the face of that overwhelming addiction?
Sure. I mean, there are two ways of sort of approaching it. You know, for me to say, you know, there is a choice, there will be a moment in your life when you can make a choice. And I'm talking to, you know, the listeners who are maybe struggling or have, you know, loved ones who are struggling. For me to say that, it would be, you know, finding a solution to a problem of addiction. So I don't like to call it a choice, because I was always choosing, you know, my sober life and my son over my addiction. I just couldn't do it. But I would say that if you do have this sort of moment of clarity where you understand that the life you're living is more painful than the life you could live with possible consequences, you know, that's the moment where you really need to hang on to that, however, you know, long or short it is. For me, you know, I like to say it was half a second or something. And once you get to that moment, it's very important to immediately go and get help. Don't sort of wait around and sit on it and think, oh, you know, I'll deal with it tomorrow. I mean, there is help out there everywhere. So,
Well, it's a very courageous book that you've written here. And thank you for sharing your story with us. And thank you for joining us today. Our guest is Jovita Bidlavska. She's the author of the book Drunk Mom, a Memoir. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Summer starts early at the Utah Olympic Park. The park adventure activities are now open weekends through May 26, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. The Comet bobsled, zip lines, alpine slide, and adventure courses are ready for some action. Starting Saturday, May 31st, the park moves to a daily schedule with extended hours. For season passes and more info, go to UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with Tim Henney. Want to thank our guest today, Philippe Petit, the man on wire, also Austin Kleon with his book Show Your Work, and finally Jovita Bidlavska, the author of Drunk Mom, a Memoir. And our underwriters.
Our underwriters are Park City Clinic, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, and our newest sponsor, Vento Pizzeria.
Yum! And tune in tomorrow to Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. talking with some always interesting topics, science and technology. And of course, you can look up any of our archive shows, usually posted the day of the interview, so later on today, at kpcw.org and under the Shows tab. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Time for news.